The Tom Woods Show, episode 1978.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here. David Stockman is with us today. David served as director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan. He was a U.S. congressman before that. He's the author of numerous books. In particular, the one I highly recommend is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Tremendous book, contains probably the best, most convincing case I've ever seen against the bailouts back in 2008 and thereafter. David's been doing a lot of great commentary over at his website, davidstockmanscontracorner.com. I'm linking to that on the show notes page, by the way, tomwoods.com/1978. And we're going to talk today about what we would do, or what David recommends we do, if somehow the political winds went our way and we had a sympathetic Congress and indeed a sympathetic White House. Suppose we had a David Stockman White House. What would be the things that he would want to do right away? Let's talk about what our program would be specifically. So, David, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, Tom. Lot to talk about, that's for sure.
Yeah, plenty to talk about. And, you know, the thing is, I wouldn't say I'm in a rut because I feel like I'm putting out some of the maybe the best episodes I've ever put out. But there are only so many times I can talk about vaccine passports and COVID irrationality and so on and on, even though I am obsessed with it. I can think about nothing else from the moment I wake up in the morning, but I want to have a diversity of topics. And it occurred to me after somebody raised it that we haven't really answered the question, suppose by some miracle, the Thomas Massey Party became dominant in the United States and we elected President David Stockman. Now, obviously, David Stockman would observe all the constitutional niceties and would understand that he doesn't have lawmaking powers. But as President David Stockman, and assuming he has a very sympathetic Congress, I'm just curious, what would we do? What would be the order of what we would do? What would be our aims under those circumstances? And so apparently you gave it some thought. So let's run through. Apparently you have four reforms that would be at the forefront. Let's get those out there and then take them on one at a time.
Well, Tom, my first thought on your question was I would promise not to serve if I was elected myself, because it's, you know, damn near impossible to sort out this humongous mess we have.
Well, you remember I was trying to get you trending to be named Treasury Secretary under Trump, and you would have had to resign. It would have been all my fault, and I'm glad it didn't work.
It would have lasted a couple of days. But anyway, I thought it's useful to put out the big sweeping headlines, let's say, the headings that need to be addressed that would make a huge difference. I'll have to say up front, they don't have a snowball's chance in hell of being adopted at any time soon. But at least we need to know what an authentic standard is so we can understand how far we've drifted off the beaten path and how much danger both capitalist prosperity and constitutional liberty is really in. So here are my four things. I'll just hit the high spot and then we can go into some detail. One, reform the Fed root and branch. And I can go through some key things about that that go far beyond what, you know, some Washington writers may talk about today. Two, hogtie the budget with stern pay-go rules, and I think there's a way to do that. Third, rescue the 10th Amendment and refederalize all of the welfare and education programs that have been usurped by Washington, send them back to the states. And four, chop the defense budget to the Eisenhower minimum, which today happens to be $330 billion, the amount that he actually said was enough to keep America safe in 1960, in current dollars, of course, when he gave his famous farewell address about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. Those are the four big headings: reform the Fed, hogtie the budget, rescue the 10th Amendment and slash the fence and bring the troops home, because our national security doesn't require all the bases and occupations and so forth that we have around the world. Now, there's a lot of detail under each of those headings, but I think it's good to get the big picture out first.
Yes, right. So let's start indeed with the Fed. Now, I don't know, again, how much could be done through executive order, or obviously the Fed was created by an act of Congress, so I don't know if there has to be some congressional, that almost doesn't even matter. I just want to know what you would want to do.
Okay.
But what do you have in mind for reforming the Fed and whether it can be reformed? Because the problem is that Fed started off with a fairly modest, if you might call, mandate, and now it has this ridiculous economic planning mandate. How would you ever keep it in a box, even if you did reform it?
Well, that's a good question, but I would actually go back to Carter Glass's idea of a banker's bank at the Fed, 12 regional reserve banks with a very limited role. And of course, we're a democracy, so if you got the thing straightened out, somebody could probably screw it up down the road a few decades, but you need to lay out what to do. So here's what's under my heading of root and branch reform of the Fed. One, repeal Humphrey Hawkins and all the legislative mandates, because those have to do with Keynesian macro management, and the central bank shouldn't be in that business. Number two, make it illegal for the Fed to actually own government debt or agency debt, because the Fed should not be in the business of monetizing the public debt. Number three, abolish the FOMC, the Open Market Committee, and get the Fed out of the price targeting, interest rate targeting, which is just the price of money, and debt targeting, and stock market coddling and supporting. Get them out of the business of interfering in the pricing process of the financial markets and the falsification of prices for debt, equity, and other securities. Because after all, that's why they intervene so heavily. They think the market's wrong and they know what the right interest rate is and the right yield curve spread, over the maturity spectrum and what the stock index level ought to be or not be. Get them out of that entirely. And four, return to, as I started here, Carter Glass, he was the author, House Banking Committee author, of the Fed Act in 1913. And his notion was the Fed is a banker's bank. It does nothing but passively supply funding through the discount window. That's huge. You got to go back to the discount window only, not this constant daily multi-billion dollar intervention in the every aspect of the financial markets. Discount window only. Discount window would basically make cash available to banks in the system when they presented good commercial collateral, basically receivables for goods already made and shipped. So therefore, any expansion of the money supply, this was called the real bills doctrine back in the old days, and that's what Carter Glass actually believed in, and that was the founding principle of the Fed, actually, in 1913. Get back to the real bills doctrine that said, unless there's production that has already happened and goods that are already produced and on the shelf and waiting to be paid for, that's the only decent collateral to put behind any new credits created by the Fed. That ties the Fed's action to real developments in the Main Street economy. In other words, entrepreneurs and businesses and workers produce output, and that output then becomes the standard for any money creation in the system. And of course, if you do come to the discount window, which frankly was the Fed's tool, as some students of this know, for decades and decades, the discount rate was important, the discount window was important. And in modern times, it's Keynesian jerks that took it over, beginning with Bernanke, but frankly, I blame Greenspan in part, started this whole idea that there's a stigma attached to going to the discount window, that customers of the bank might get worried the bank goes to the discount window. Well, hell yes, they should get worried. When the bank goes to the discount window, it's because they've overloaned, they've gotten to the edge of liquidity, they're not doing their business properly. And so, you know, they should, one, have to go to the discount window, two, be exposed, and three, pay a penalty spread. And I'm saying the word here very carefully, spread above whatever the open market interest rate is. It's not the Fed targeting, you know, the overnight rate, which is like 15 basis points today. The rate should be what the market sets. And anybody that wants to go to the discount window pays that rate plus, say, 100 basis points or 200 basis points. And that would discipline the banking system like nothing that you can imagine at the present time. What this really would do, when you abstract away from some of this detail, is it would get the Fed out of the monetary central planning business. It wouldn't care what the unemployment rate is. It wouldn't care about how many housing starts, whether GDP grew by 4% or 2% or 0% last quarter. It doesn't matter. That's the business of market capitalism. That's the business of 160 million workers and millions of businesses and entrepreneurs. It is not the kind of Gosplan in modern guise to be set and driven by, you know, 12 people on the open market committee who couldn't possibly know where the world is going. So that's the key thing. The Fed then becomes only a last resort supplier of liquidity against good collateral driven by the commercial economy. We wouldn't have any Keynesian economists. Send them all back to Harvard, University of Chicago, UCLA, wherever the hell they come from. And the only thing you need on this kind of Fed, the Carter Glass Fed, is green eye shades who know how to examine collateral and decide whether they're going to accept it as presented by bankers, banks that are members of the system. This would make a world of difference. I can't even begin to outline what it would mean. But number two things are really important. Number one, it would be out of the debt monetization business. And Congress would then have to face, you know, the honest cost of these huge spending and deficit sprees. Sure, let them, you know, I'll get to the other part in a moment. But if they run deficits, it ought to be financed in the bond market where they squeeze out someone else, drive up interest rates, and cause countervailing economic harm, which alerts people to the fact that the Fed is doing the wrong thing. That'd be the first thing. You're never going to get any fiscal discipline as long as we have a Fed in the mode of, you know, monetizing damn near all the debt that's been created. I checked it the other day, and of the, you know, roughly $5 trillion of additional debt since this whole COVID lockdown bailout mania started in March 2020, about 87% of it has been monetized, and it would stop that. The second thing is our economy is just riddled with deadweight cost or malinvestment, as we call it, in purely speculative activities that have no value added, no purpose other than they are enabled by this massive constant flow of liquidity that comes from the Federal Reserve. Now, if you got the gambling out of the private sector and you got the borrowing out of the government sector as a result of this fundamental reform I'm talking about, you'd be talking about a much more productive, healthy, stable, and sustainable society and economy.
All right. So very quickly, reviewing this, do you mean to say that the Fed would not be allowed to make any purchases of anything at all?
They would not be allowed to make any purchases on their own motion. They could only respond passively. That was the Carter Glass Bank, the banker's bank, to collateral presented by real players in the economy. Right.
All right. Because obviously buying treasuries, these open market purchases, are the mechanism of monetary policy. So are you saying that the Fed that you envision wouldn't, strictly speaking, have a monetary policy?
No. The Fed I'm speaking of, we don't need a monetary policy. That's just appropriated when the Keynesians figured out they couldn't sell fiscal activism completely. You know, they tried it under Kennedy and Johnson and came a cropper in the 70s and in ill repute when we were all in there with Reagan. They just, shuffled around for a decade or so and then came in the back door through the Fed through the central bank and, you know, decided to turn monetary policy, as I say, into monetary central planning. You don't need a monetary policy. You really don't. The Fed would function as a backup source of liquidity to the banking system. And the outcome in the economy, whether it's a high growth economy, a low growth economy, it would be a function of, you know, what the producers and consumers and workers collectively generated.
I'm going to put on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1978, an article by Guido Holtzman, biographer of Mises, called Against Monetary Policy. It's a great piece. All right, let's go to the next one. Hogtie the budget. Now, I don't know, didn't we have Graham Rudman? There's always some emergency clause, and they always manage to find an emergency. How do you fight that?
Well, I had a personal experience in life where I had some idiots in the Justice Department come after me when I was in the private sector running companies on the grounds they claimed, and of course they eventually dropped the case, but that I had certified as the CEO of a company the financial statements that weren't true. Well, they were true, and the whole case was a crock, and there was a, you know, U.S. attorney trying to make a name for herself. But I learned from that a very simple thing. What we would have is a enhanced pay-as-you-go system, which would require that 3 months before the beginning of every fiscal year, the president, secretary of the treasury, the director of OMB, let's throw in the speaker of the house and the leader of the senate as well, would have to certify that they are ordering a pro rata cut in every spending from every program from A to Z in the budget to bring projected spending in line with current law revenue. They would be required to do that. And you can say, well, you know, if you didn't have my little gimmick in here, not gimmick, it's actually pretty profound, you didn't have my little mechanism in here, well, then they would certify it looks like we're going to be in balance because there's going to be a boom next November, you know, and so we don't have to have any pro rata cut. No, they would have to certify, just like every CEO and every CFO in America, on penalty of death, not death, but excuse me, on penalty of criminal liability, has to certify the SEC that its statements that it files quarterly are accurate, fair, balanced, and true. Okay. And I would apply the same damn thing to the president and the other officers I mentioned. And if it turns out that they were faking and they didn't provide for the big pro rata cut that would be needed to balance the budget every year, they would be subject to criminal liability. That would change the dynamics entirely. And then, after all, why are they so special? As I said, every CFO and CEO in America is under that standard right now, and we take it as a matter of course. Every now and then, there's a bad apple, but mostly financial statements, you know, they're misinterpreted by Wall Street, but as they're filed with the SEC, they're generally pretty honest because, you know, there's a pretty good disciplining mechanism built into the law. So that's what I would do. I don't think you need the balanced budget amendment. It's I don't know how you ever get it through the states. I think it's very hard to imagine one that would work. But I would just have this mechanism, an enhanced PAYGO, built into the law so that you would get this hard look at the coming year. Forget these 5 years and 10 years. They just make stuff up, and there's so many gimmicks and ways around it. It's meaningless. Let's do it 1 year at a time on the horizon that we can see, and put the chief officers of the government in harm's way if they don't certify, you know, a 5% cut, if that's what's going to be needed to bring the accounts into balance. That would change everything.
Now, incidentally, I know that there are interest groups upon interest groups that would, you know, everybody being subject to these cuts would be violently against this. We're not really looking into the practicality of it. We're saying if we had the political capital to do it,
yeah,
what would you start with? So it's not a response to say they won't let you do that. It's if we could do it, what would we do? So then the third thing is pretending once again that the 10th Amendment is in the Constitution.
Right.
And now I have a friend, Kevin Gutzman, who's a biographer of both Madison and Jefferson, and he has both a PhD in history and a law degree. And he's told me that when he was preparing for the bar exam and taking one of those crash courses, they actually said to him, in the multiple choice section, if you get any question where one of the options is the 10th Amendment, you can just eliminate that because that's never the right answer.
It's kind of been put in the memory hole, disappeared, as they say. You're exactly right. But I think here's what's really important about the 10th Amendment. It's not just kind of originalism here or, you know, literalism as to what the founders were writing or what the document really says. That's part of it, of course. That gives it its roots and its legitimacy. But the real point is the only way you're ever going to control the giveaways and the welfare and, you know, the money that flows into the teachers' unions and the bureaucrats is if you unleash competition between the states. So put the food stamps back to the states, put all the education programs back to the states. There's about 800 billion of means-tested welfare type programs, including housing and all the rest of the in-kind, you know, welfare benefits that we have. So if California wants to make it really easy to load up on all that stuff, they would get all the, you know, freeloaders in California, and all the workers would go to Texas, and pretty soon Texas would be booming and California would be in tough shape and policies would change. And, you know, that is very important. It's pretty clear that in a country as big and complicated and distracted with so many things as we are, you're never going to control this fundamental issue of free stuff and giveaways and taxing the producers to, you know, give money to the non-producers, unless you basically send it back to the states. And then, as, you know, Justice Brandeis said, let the states be the true laboratory of democracy that they are. And some states would find that a disciplined approach would make their voters a lot happier and their people a lot more prosperous than what New York and California would likely do. And eventually, they would have to face the music rather than a log roll in Congress like they do at present.
Hey, folks, let's thank our sponsor, Blinkist. You are a wonderful person, I am sure, but Old Woods here is going to help make you a better version of yourself. And don't we all want that? A more informed, confident you? Well, the Blinkist app helps you do that painlessly. There are a million books you want to read to improve yourself, to learn more. You're never going to get to all of them. Blinkist takes top nonfiction titles, pulls out the key takeaways, puts them into text and audio explainers called Blinks that give you only the most important information in just 15 minutes. Blinkist takes top nonfiction titles, pulls out the key takeaways, puts them into text and audio explainers called Blinks that give you the most important information in just 15 minutes. And as you know as well as I do, a lot of modern books are full of fluff, and all you really need are those 15 minutes. On the other hand, those 15 minutes can tell you whether or not this is something you want to explore further without having invested hours and hours of your time. On Blinkist, you'll find nonfiction titles in 27 different categories, ranging from modern bestsellers to even libertarian classics like Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman or For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard, and also old, old classics like Machiavelli's The Prince and Seneca's Letters from a Stoic about what the good life is all about. I find Blinkist is a great way to fill dead time while I'm driving around, and it makes me feel efficient and informed. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Wasn't it interesting under Trump that we were hearing the 10th Amendment cited in New York and other places when Trump said, I want to open up the country? But Now with Biden wanting to punish everybody, the 10th Amendment is nowhere to be found.
Right, exactly. No, but I think it's not only on this whole matter of welfare, the 800 billion or so of means-tested programs, but generally the country's too big and complex to have one rule, one size fits all. There's way too much power in Washington, and what the hell do we have? I checked once a while back, there's 87,500 roughly units of government in the United States, including counties and municipalities and school districts and other special purpose districts, as well as the state and federal government. And if everything's going to be done in one of those, the federal government, Washington, what the hell's the point of the 87,000 other units of government that, you know, are the root source of our democracy and that we spend an awful lot of time collectively choosing office holders and, you know, going through the motions. So the 10th Amendment is probably one of the most important things that conservatives and libertarians could actually rally to, and not just on the fiscal issue, I'm applying it here, but on a lot of other issues as well.
All right. And finally, let's go on ahead to the so-called defense budget. It's all offense, but the defense budget being chopped. Now, again, we're assuming this is a fantasy world where the interests involved haven't shot Professor Stockman.
Yeah.
President Stockman, right? I can't imagine what the response would be. And of course, it would be wild propaganda and hysteria about what would happen. And this would be echoed. It's so funny that left liberals have somehow a reputation being anti-war. Yeah. It would be the Washington Post, the New York Times would be screaming about this.
Well, you know, on that, and I'll go on to the further in the question, but you know, that's one of the terrible things that's happened in the last 30 or 40 years, because it was true when I was a kid working on Capitol Hill, and then when I got elected to Congress in 76, the left liberals were anti-war back then. Okay, McGovern was anti-war, and they all came off the Vietnam War, which was a senseless, you know, slaughter, even genocide when you look back at it now. And, you know, what was the point? We're not, Vietnam is not one of our major, you know, low-cost suppliers. What were we talking about? But in any event, those polls have been reversed. Republicans have been pretty bad on this issue all along. And, you know, the hawks and the anti-communists have just found new enemies and taken the same, you know, line about peace through strength and all this stuff. But here's where I'm coming from. Clearly, Eisenhower was one of the greatest presidents, in my view, of modern times, because he won World War II. He conducted, you know, the great Normandy landing that finally turned the tide. He understood that war is a last resort. It's a terrible, evil, unpleasant thing, and that you must always be on guard, because once they get enough resources and power, the military is going to find missions and excuses and false flag provocations, of which, you know, we could have a whole show on false flags, you know. He knew all this, and he gave that famous speech about warning of the dangers of the military-industrial complex. And the reason I pinpoint that, the reason I focus on it, is that that was early 1961 when he was leaving office. And so a while back, I said, I wonder what the defense budget was that year. Well, it turns out in the dollars of that period, dollars of the day, as we call it, it was $49.5 billion, the entire defense function. So if you just inflate that to the dollars of today, in other words, adjusted for inflation, that's $330 billion. Right. Eisenhower thought that at the peak of the Cold War, when the Russian, you know, industrial economy had not yet ossified and fallen apart completely, communism had only partly failed and it was on the way to total failure in the 1980s on its own accord. But he felt that $330 billion of today's dollars was more than enough to provide for the security of the United States in a world where there was a true, you know, superpower opponent. Now, you know, today, none of that's true. They're getting all hot and bothered about China, but China's just, you know, one gigantic Ponzi scheme, as we're learning with this latest thing going on with Evergrande and a lot of other things there. Russia, you know, has got a GDP of less than $2 trillion compared to our 20-some trillion, and NATO's 40-some trillion. There isn't the kind of industrial power enemy or antagonist in the world that Eisenhower had to face. So we don't need $750 billion. That's the budget today. We could get by with 330 because our armed forces are way the hell too big. We don't need 2.5 million men and women under arms, including the National Guard and the rest of it. We don't need 11 carrier battle groups. You know, for crying out loud, it's ridiculous. They're sitting ducks. They can't defend the New Jersey shores or the California shores. The only good they do is help you invade a place you shouldn't be invading. So I would get rid of a lot of this apparatus in both manpower and weaponry and go to what Robert Taft wanted to do in the 1950s, which was a continental defense. You would have a nuclear deterrent, which we already got. We paid for the Minutemen and the Polaris sea base deterrent. We have all we need. It's already paid for. It can be upgraded a little bit from time to time. Operating costs aren't much. And that's essentially the defense you need in the world today. All the rest of this is just interventionism for its own sake and, you know, getting in the middle of other people's quarrels for no good end. So that would be my fourth big form reform.
Well, I have to say, first of all, I like all these. I support them all. I would probably be even more radical with them, but I'm certainly happy with them as a start. I said something a little bit unpopular a few weeks ago when Biden gave an afternoon speech about the Afghanistan withdrawal. And he said, look, if we had stayed there another year, another 5 years, or left 5 years earlier, whatever, none of it would have made a bit of difference. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing because I despise this man.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a reasonable speech. Yeah. I thought it was this kind of speech that Trump should have given, frankly.
You know, I agree with you completely. And frankly, Trump wanted to give that speech. You have to give him credit. He did on his own, because he certainly didn't have any staff that was sympathetic. But every time he tried to not even withdraw, but, you know, reduce or retract missions and troop levels, he got totally sabotaged and undermined. You know, I think at most there were like 2,000 soldiers in Syria. He wanted to get them out. He can see there's no point in us being there. We didn't have any dog in that hunt, as, you know, they used to say. And he couldn't even get him out of Syria. He got sabotaged by the deep state, whatever you want to call it. He tried to see if he could make some headway with North Korea. Well, he had nice meetings. And then when he got back, they spent the rest of them spent all their time, you know, undermining and reversing the progress that had been made. You know, he actually would have done, some decent deals with Putin, you know, some arms control. Putin doesn't want arms either. He's got a country that is desperate in terms of resources it needs for its own population. But he couldn't. I mean, they would have eaten him alive. They would have roasted him on Pennsylvania Avenue if he had tried to really have a serious summit or series of summits with Putin. Like, frankly, if we all remember, Eisenhower had with Khrushchev back in the 1950s, late 50s. And he got sabotaged by the Dulles brothers and the CIA, as you know, the whole U2 thing was set up to stop the upcoming summit from really producing some material arms agreements. So in a way, Trump didn't have a tenth of Eisenhower's savvy and experience and character and all the rest of it. But he tried to do roughly the same thing, and he ended up being totally thwarted and stifled by the powers that be. In fact, ironically, the very military-industrial surveillance security state apparatus that Eisenhower warned about.
It's interesting then that Biden got away with it. I mean, Biden, even though both Biden and Trump are in their 70s, Trump seems much more vigorous and robust. Biden seems more hesitating and weak. I mean, in the physical sense of weak, he stumbles over himself. He does not seem like a self-assured person. And yet somehow he stared down the military-industrial complex.
You got to hand it to him for that. And I don't know how it happened, but, you know, if you look at the record, he was obviously, he's been, I would say he's about 95% wrong on almost anything I could think of. But on some of these issues, he's been okay. I mean, in 2009, he told Obama, don't fall for this surge bit from Petraeus and McChrystal and all the rest of these generals. It didn't work in Iraq, and there's no reason to think it's going to work in the foothills of the Himalayas or the Hindu Kush, you know, godforsaken place, the most godforsaken place on earth. So he was on the right side. He got overruled, you know. I mean, Obama was so stupid, he brings in Gates as his Secretary of Defense. I mean, you know, that's like, you know, putting a fox in the chicken coop. But in any event, he seemed to be right on a few things along the way. And fortunately, you know, he was able to stand up and take the heat. Now, the thing that bugs me, if you want to know, Tom, is these idiotic Republicans are now pretending, well, this is another Benghazi, or they're going back to idiocy like who lost China in 1949? I mean, they should be on the warpath. Why did it take so long? And why did you spend $2.2 trillion? Why did we lose, you know, the 3,000 or 2,500 soldiers that we did, to say nothing of like 150,000 civilian casualties in a country that couldn't possibly, you know, harm us or impact our national security. So, you know, I guess everybody stumbles into something that's correct. And on this one, he did. So we should acknowledge that.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. No kidding. Absolutely. Well, as we wrap up, tell us a little bit about what you've been discussing lately at David Stockman's Contra Corner so we can get some people over there.
Well, you know, my big theme right now is the whole inflation thing, okay? And I'm trying to write in a lot of different ways that the inflation has been here all along. When you create money at the rate that we have, okay, you know, just in the last 18 months or so, the Fed's balance sheet has expanded by $4.6 billion, or more than doubled, you know, that this has created a tremendous amount of inflation in the financial markets. Bonds are way overpriced, which means the yields are so low that the government can borrow with almost, you know, no cost. There's a massive amount of speculation that's being fueled by this, and, you know, all the crazy stuff we've had this year with the cryptos, and I'm a fan of non-state money, but the whole cryptoverse, as we call it, there's 11,000 cryptocurrencies out there right now being totally polluted by this massive flow of fiat liquidity, $120 billion a month that's being pumped in by the Fed and followed by a lot of other central banks around the world. So what I'm trying to do here is to say, yeah, now finally we're getting some goods and services inflation, but the idea that what we've been doing for the last 30 years isn't inflationary is totally wrong. It's terribly inflationary. That's where we have these crazy valuations from the, you know, length and breadth of the stock market. And I've been going into a lot of that just to show people, you know, how nuts this really is. And of course, the morning after, everybody will see it, but somehow they can't see it now. Now, maybe as we get these events like the Evergrande blow up that's happening this week, it's in China, but it doesn't matter that it's in China. It's simply a case writ large of the kind of reckless debt building and speculative enterprise that's been fueled by the central banks, including the People's Bank of China. And, you know, it's not a one-off. It's not something happening way over there in what I call the red Ponzi. I mean, there's a lot of Evergrandes here, you know, not quite as blatant as owing $300 billion as they do, but still the principle, the point is the same. So, you know, this is going to lead to a major showdown. I think what I'm getting to is the Fed is finally going to lose its way. In other words, you can only go so far with the rationalizations and the excuses and all the other nonsense that you hear from Powell. But I think we're reaching the point soon where the goods and services inflation is high enough that the Fed's case, assurance that it's all transitory and we're just catching up for low inflation in the past, all of that's going to become you know, seriously challenged, if not repudiated. And then I think the Fed heads are going to go in a lot of different directions. They're not going to have consensus. It'll be uncertain as to whether what they're going to do next. The markets will lose confidence that they get bailed out by a Fed that's fractured and divided. And when that happens, you know, it's Katie bar the door, because there is literally tens of trillions worth of speculative excess out there today in the markets that is going to come out sooner or later.
Well, I strongly recommend folks you check out. It's a long domain name, but it's worth typing in. David Stockman's ContraCorner.com. And I will link to that at TomWoods.com/1978. And you can find out what's really going on in the world, which you get some of on the Tom Woods Show, but not the full picture. For the full picture, you need David Stockman's Contra Corner. So go check that out. And David, thank you for your time, and thank you for thinking over my question such that you actually came prepared with four specific reforms. I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good to be with you, and we'll discuss these things again sometime.
All right, folks, two things before we head out. The first one won't apply to everybody, but it is a message I want to relay from a Tom Woods Show listener. He runs Finley Consulting Group, which brings high-performance building and closure solutions to building and homeowners, architects, and contractors anywhere in the world. Uncontrolled rainwater penetration and condensation leading to moisture-related deterioration are two of the most common threats to structural integrity and performance of the modern building envelope. Today, they represent up to 80% of all construction-related claims in the U.S. You can avoid these building envelope issues by engaging Finley Consulting Group to bring their 13-plus years of experience to your new construction project. If you have an existing building or residence with building envelope issues or want to improve the functionality and efficiency of your building envelope, Finley Consulting Group can provide investigative services and provide expert, innovative, and cost-effective solutions to remedy your building enclosure issues. To find out more, head to finleycg.com. That's FINLEYCG.com. Now, the second thing is tomorrow on the program, I'm having somebody from Praxis back on. It's been a long time since I've spoken to those folks. A lot of you know Praxis. Some of you have even gone through their program. But this is an organization that helps people who don't want to go through the expected 4 years of college and then sit by the phone waiting for somebody to call them with a job offer. It's very different. It's an internship or apprenticeship sort of program where you have a six-month boot camp and then another 6 months interning at a startup. And then at the end of that internship, you can keep working there as your job if you want with the experience you've gotten. And you'll be 3 years ahead of your peers who will be spending those 3 years racking up debt, and you'll be spending those 3 years making money and getting experience. So it's really important, especially at a time like this. And I'm having them on because they're doing something special for students who are stuck on campuses where there are these sudden vaccine mandates. And they're doing something extra to help them out. So tune in to that. Now, you may say, well, I'm not in college, or my kids aren't in college. Probably you know somebody who is. But meanwhile, whether you're in college or not, these are things that are affecting our society and that are affecting people who don't deserve this kind of treatment. There are a lot of people suffering under vaccine mandates that don't apply to me. I work for myself, and none of that stuff applies to me, but I still listen to it. I'm still interested in it. I'm still engaged with it. And I would ask you to be too, because we're all suffering in one way or another from these crazy demands being made on us. So that's tomorrow's episode, 1979. So I hope you'll tune in for that, and thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.